I'm so pleased to be speaking to author Lee Christine about Dead Horse Gap, the third of her Snowy Mountains, what will I call them, murder mysteries, detective stories, crime stories. It's published by Allen and Unwin in 2022, and it's a really cracking read. I loved it, Lee, so delighted to be speaking to you about it.
It's lovely to be speaking to you again, Barbie. Thank you for that.
I was also, just before we connected with one another on Zoom here, I was looking at Nada Bakovic's beautiful cover. I do think she's a wonderful cover artist, and the cover is perfect, this wonderful picture of the hut, which does play a part in the story, and that fantastic Snowy Mountains environment. Tell me about your interest in the Snowies, because now you've written three times about this place, and of course there's so much to see there, and so much goes on in terms of the snow industry when we're not blighted by COVID, but it's just beautiful national park area. And I wondered whether you're a skier or a person who has skiing in the family, because it's such a strong part of the story.
Yeah, exactly. And first, again, just before we start, yes, Nada, the cover is beautiful. And Mike Edmondson, who's a photographer from down there, they licensed his photograph of the Cascades Hut for all the promotion and for the book. So I really love that cover. I've loved all my covers, but that one's my favourite. As far as my setting for the trilogy, I do have a love of the mountains. I mean, I live by the sea, but I gravitate to the mountains. I live a couple of blocks from the beach and I don't swim in the beach. I love walking by the beach, but I've always gravitated to the mountains. And I think it started when I was in year eight at school, and they took us down there on an excursion, and we went skiing and we went through the Snowy Hydro Information Centre. And then when I started working, I had a couple of weekends down there away, and I met my husband and we started skiing. And then we had children and we kept taking them back down to the mountains. And my daughter said to us, I remember her saying very clearly, can you take me down here every year? I absolutely love it. And we thought, oh, okay. And she did. She really took to it like a duck to water. And she ended up becoming a ski instructor and did seven seasons in the snow, both in the US, Canada, and in Australia. So we kept going back and back again, but not just in the ski season. We went back in summer. So we did a lot of hiking. We hiked the Kosciuszko Summit, you know, we walked around the beautiful Dead Horse Gap Thredbo River walk. We even went down to the Thredbo Jazz Festival. So I keep going back down there. It's a favourite destination. And since I've started writing the books, or I have written the books down there, I have learned more and more about the area and gotten to know, you know, you sort of pick up on the types of people who have settled there, who have been there for long term, who are itinerant workers following the endless winter of Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere. And I've gone wider in this book, as you probably noticed, where the first two were sort of locked down in small ski resorts. This one has spread further over the Kosciuszko National Park. But yes, I do have a particular love of that area.
Well, so many beautiful places. And of course, mountain areas like this are visually beautiful, but they are quite treacherous. You know, I've been walking in the summer in Kosciuszko and a blizzard has come across, and you just have to be alert to that all the time. And I think that notion of inherent danger supports your story so beautifully. But the story starts, and this is a fascinating beginning for you, with the crash of a light aircraft at Kankoban Airport. Now, people who are flyers of light aircraft will tell you that it's quite tricky flying into there because you've got mountains on either side and, you know, they have to be pretty experienced flyers and on the ball to get into that airport. But in the case of your story, one of the members of the main family of this story, the Lorimers, flies in and crashes into a mower, a sit-on mower that's been left apparently deliberately, or is it by accident, on the runway. And that's where the investigation kicks off. And because it's suspicious, it brings in your Sydney homicide detectives, Sergeant Pierce Ryder, and his Offsider, Detective Constable Mitchell Flowers. I love the names of your characters. They're really appealing, and you do make a bit of a story out of some of them, I must admit. But meanwhile, another police officer is down in that area already in an undercover role. And this is where this story, I guess, moves slightly away from your previous two, in that you've got two of the lesser characters from the early books who come to the fore and take a main role. And in particular, this gutsy female police officer who's working undercover. Now, tell me about this emphasis on the female police officer, the heroine, if you like, of the story, and her courage, but also the isolation of being in the undercover role.
Detective Nerida Sterling, yes, is the only female member of the homicide squad. And I introduced her in Crackenback, the second book, and she was just a newcomer. She came down from Taree. And Nerida has had a bit of a, you know, if I guess there's some readers out there who have read Crackenback. She's had a bad experience. She was sidelined. She was put into a bit of a dead-end team. And so when she joins the homicide squad, she's very conscious of that, that she's the latest recruit. She's the only female that, you know, she has to prove herself, and she got herself in a bit of a situation in Taree. So she's very, very careful not to do that again, not to make the same mistake again. She's someone who learns from her mistakes. She's very practical and all of that. She volunteers when they need someone young who can fit into the ski scene, I guess, while the ski season's underway, who can mix in and just keep her eyes and ears open, because the case that they've been working on involving a criminal gang, a drug gang in the mountains, is sort of, you know, it's stalled. And so they think it's worthwhile to put someone in there and keep their eyes and ears open. So she volunteers, but, you know, I try to get across in the novel here about a young detective in a strange town, a very small town. And for readers that might not know Kankovan, it was built for the first Snowy, to house the workers of the first Snowy Hydro build. It's now mostly a tourist town, but she's down there, she's living amongst strangers, and she's lonely, and that sort of loneliness takes her by surprise. She's feeling isolated from the rest of the squad, and while they're keeping her up to date by Flowers's, you know, sort of ringing in of a night to have a bit of a chat with her and to expand a bit on the case notes that she's seeing updated. So yes, I had a great time writing Nerida, and one of the things that was a little bit tricky is because I was used to writing her as the practical police detective, you know, very pragmatic, you know, doesn't lose a head and very sensible. And yet she's in this role where she has to mix with the community. She's working in a pub and she virtually is acting, you know, as somebody else. And that was tricky, switching between sensible Nerida and Nerida, who's a bit more bubbly and vivacious and mucking around a little bit with the locals and the person that owns the hotel and that kind of thing. So that was challenging, but also interesting to write her that way.
Yes, she gets quite into that role and quite enjoys it, I think, particularly when she's having a little bit of a go at Mitch in public and taking people by surprise with how much of a good barmaid she can be. But the issue of sexism in the police force has been written about recently by quite a lot of crime writers, and particularly the Australian police force, and in the rural setting as well. So it seems to be something that's very much in people's minds. There are obviously lots of efforts underway to try and overcome some of this culture of sexism, but I think it's probably a long way from moving as it is in other fields.
Yeah, I agree, Barbie. And I mean, I have a Sydney detective who I run all my police procedural things past, and he's kind enough to speak to me for hours on the phone. And he's been in the gang squad and the homicide squad. And he will admit, yes, these things do happen. They have happened in the past, and it's still a challenge now, and that attitudes need to change. So I had a good conversation with him about that.
It's interesting because it's one of the things that comes up in George Gently in this TV series from the 60s, when the way that female police officers are treated very much as people who can bring in the coffee is a topic. And George, of course, is not of that ilk. but it's a culture that was obviously apparent to people then and still seems to be an issue. Anyway, let's move on to the story, because this story is, as you say, about a drug ring. You've got this beneath story of a drug person who has died in that area, and the solution to that crime is still hanging in the air. And it's apparent that there is still drug trafficking going on there, but they can't quite get to the bottom of it. And then this crash of the aeroplane seems to present a second story. And it's the story of the Lorimer family, who have been in a long-standing, though I guess simmering down to nothing much happening, feud, which has occurred over land use and snow leases. Tell me about the snow leases and that history of the Snowy as a grazing area. And of course, all of these things have changed now with the National Park and some provisions being made to protect the environment, not quite with the horses yet, but in other ways. But there was a long history of grazing in that area, wasn't there?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, during my research for the book, I was on Trove and, you know, I stumbled across, or in my searches came up, you know, New South Wales government and snow leases that they had down there. I thought, oh, this is great. And I was went down the rabbit hole and started researching about the snow leases. But yes, the cattle in the summer months, they were taken up to the higher country, to the cooler climes, when, you know, the farms and the grass would have been dry and maybe in drought. And some of the stock routes were a kilometre wide and they'd come from as far away as Hay. And I have a good friend who is born and bred in Tumbarumba and lived there until she was married. Her father has just recently died and he owned the menswear shop in Tumbarumba for decades. And I've been talking to her about it and the history of her family and everything growing up in Tumbarumba. So the snow leases were granted to graziers so that they could come up and bring their cattle up. But then, of course, with the national parks, and they found out that, you know, because I think they used to burn the grass so that it would shoot up again for the next time that they were there. And so it started degrading the land and the soil. And there was all sorts of an environmental impact on the mountain area, our alpine areas, which are very fragile, the sphagnum moss and the snow gums, and of course the water that goes into Warragamba Dam. So when the national parks took over that, they gradually phased out these snow leases. So I try to bring into the story, if anyone's read Charlotte Pass, you know, a bit of local history. So in Charlotte Pass, there was the ill-fated chairlift between Charlotte Pass and Threadbow. It only lasted one season. It was this little known piece of infrastructure on the roof of Australia. So just bringing in the snow leases, and that again is something that I thought, like the alpine huts, that people who don't live in the area may not have discovered about Australia yet. And I guess it was fresh in my mind from the 2020 fires of how many alpine huts we had lost down there and how they rebuild them and that. So yes, the snow leases, I thought that is a good way to bring in this family feud, that, you know, maybe someone snatched a snow lease or let it lapse and another family or grazier has jumped on that snow lease. That would be a good way to introduce this feud. So that's where that came from.
So the feuds between the Buchanans and the Lorimers. I don't want to give away too much of the story and the significant things that happen, but I will say that the Lorimer family is in dispute with itself. And the death of Art Lorimer, the guy who was the pilot, who was a bit of a black sheep, does seem to come at a very convenient time and so rouses some suspicions, because the Lorimer family wants to subdivide their land. And, you know, we all know about skullduggery on councils and approvals for development and all of that sort of thing happening all over Australia, probably all over the world. But there seems to be this undercurrent of what's going on with the subdivision of the land, and will the contracts for that be signed, and who is opposed and who's in favour of it, and what have they got to get out of it? And then you've got this other younger member of the family, Heidi, who's a bit of a kind of pathetic female figure who flows through the story, being, I guess, a bit downtrodden looking, and she seems to be hanging out with the wrong people and so on. And I'm not going to go developing any of that because it would give away too much of the plot, and we don't want to spoil the story, because all of your stories, that, you know, they really are quite plot driven. But I did find in this one, there's such a lot of interest for me in the characters And one of those characters, Mitch, turns out to have a little secret too. And we do as readers twig sort of to what he's doing, because he's keeping these 24-hour schedules up and logging into his computer in the wee small hours of the night. We don't find out till quite a bit later what he's up to, and that it's not anything criminal, but he is trying to look for a new existence, isn't he, Mitch? He's an interesting character. He's very sweet on Nerida, but he doesn't want to step into that situation because they've had a bit of a fling in the past and he feels like it's a bit uncomfortable between them. And yet he does have another secret, and she's the only one that he lets into the secret. Tell me about the relationship as you developed it between Nerida and Mitch, without giving away all the secrets of the story.
Yeah, I think with Nerida and Mitch, I sort of hinted it in Crackenback that, you know, she sort of turned up from Taree. She was a country girl and she had the Invisalign braces on her teeth that made her sort of not be able to pronounce her S's correctly, which he thought was pretty cute back in Crackenback. So that was really the only, I think he tells Ryder in Crackenback that, you know, I like her. She's really nice. I think she'll be a good fit for the squad. And so I just sort of hinted at it there. But yes, in this one, because they are more the central characters rather than Ryder, I just think that when I was thinking about it, you know, I brought in a bit of backstory as what happened in the past without actually going into it. So they were at this particular point in time where they were separated, working in the same squad, but separated from each other. So I thought that was a good idea of keeping them apart. It was a good way to keep them apart, but also for them to grow closer by him telling Ryder that he would ring her each night to fill her in case she needed any information. And also Ryder's sort of catching up with her from time to time to see how she's going, but Mitch is more her age and, you know, more able to, they've got more camaraderie, I guess. That was interesting, a good way of keeping them apart romantically, but having them grow closer together by what they were learning in these conversations of a nighttime. You know, that's when they also discovered that they kind of missed each other. Yeah, I did have fun with that, but with my books, I do try not to let the romantic elements outweigh the actual plot and the crime story. They are just elements there to enhance the story, but also I think when the characters care about each other, then the stakes are higher, aren't they?
Indeed. And it's interesting that I see that you did receive a Romance Writers Award recently, not for this book. I found that interesting because I don't actually in my head see your books as romances. I do see them very strongly in the crime genre. I mean, those relationships are important, I guess, in any story because it adds verisimilitude to what you're writing. And you have the same thing going on with Pierce Ryder and his partner, Vanessa, because he's a little bit torn as well. He's undertaken to move out of his city role in the future and let some of that go, I guess, the buzz of the city police life, and to move down into a country environment with Vanessa. So he's conflicted about that as well. He knows that he's made the commitment, the relationship with Vanessa is important, more important than his job, obviously. And yet at the same time, he's struggling with that. And I'm wondering whether in a future story, we're going to see that come to the fore and developed as well, because it's an interesting, and I guess a pretty common sort of thing for many people where they have to make a choice between a personal relationship and general family well-being and a high-powered job. And I guess it probably happens to police officers as much as to anybody.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think that's what I tried to make this story about. The themes in the story was priorities. And so it's priorities sort of for all of them, the police and the families, the two, you know, involved in this feud. Because with Ryder, what is his priority? It obviously is, you know, moving out west with Vanessa. But yes, he's still sort of conflicted there because it is very prestigious. The homicide squad is the pinnacle. And then again, Flowers is working out his priorities and his life. And then Sterling as well, because as I mentioned, she's all about the force. So it's those commitments and those obligations, as far as the Lorimers go, obligations, family obligations, whether they're the obligations that the characters have taken on themselves or whether they're obligations that have been thrust upon them. So that was sort of a theme that I had going on with the police and with some of the members of the families as well.
Yes, all the people who come under suspicion. You've got some lovely, interesting local characters. You've got your local police officer, and he's one that we keep having doubts about. We're wondering whether he's in cahoots with the councillor or with bad people. And so you get this wonderful ongoing wondering for the reader of whether he's up to no good. Can he be trusted? At one point in the story, he does do the wrong thing and we think, aha, and then we realise, no, we shouldn't be rushing to conclusions. We also have the lovely Ben Hoff, the airport manager, and again, this other, as I said, love your use of names, Orville Parrish, who is the guy who does the lawn mowing and has been doing the lawn mowing since the year dot on the airport. So you've got this little assemblage of locals, then you've got the guy who runs the pub where Nerida is working undercover, and a few quite nasty pieces of work. So we're very, very well stocked with interesting characters to absorb us and also to carry us down quite a few red herrings. It's a wonderfully woven story and so enjoyable. I must admit that when I was getting towards the end of it, I just read on till about 3 a.m. because I thought, oh, I've just got to know what happens and will everybody come out all right? Because we are a bit afraid for some of these characters at some point. It's really engrossing writing, Lee Christine.
Oh, thank you. Gap.
I think it's a masterpiece, published by Allen and Unwin this year, 2022, and available everywhere. Thank you so much for spending some time with me to talk about this work.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Barbie. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.